Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is David Pilgrim. He's a professor, orator, and human rights activist. He's best known as the founder and curator of the Jim Crow Museum, a 10,000-piece collection of racist artifacts located at Ferris State University, which uses objects of intolerance to teach about race relations and racism. He is the author of Understanding Jim Crow. Well, first off, thank you for your work, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you for having me.
So my first question is, what is Jim Crow, and also what is the Jim Crow Museum, and third, what do you hope to accomplish, and what have you accomplished with the museum?
Well, the Jim Crow, well, let's put it this way, I travel and give talks, and I always ask that question to the audience. I'll say, well, what was Jim Crow? And the best answers I get, are the closest answers rather, are the most accurate answers I get. Someone will raise their hand and say, well, Jim Crow was a set of laws that were designed to subjugate African Americans, keep them at the bottom. And that's a fairly good answer, but a better answer would be that Jim Crow, it was a way of life. It would be attitudes, tastes, values, everything necessary to sustain a racial hierarchy that had whites at the top and blacks at the bottom. It also included everyday objects, and that's where we focus. Those objects, you know, functionally propaganda, would be everything from postcards, toys, sheet music, fishing lures. If you can think of an everyday object that was a Jim Crow version of it, a racist version of it used to support this racial hierarchy. So it was also the way people interacted. If an African American and a European American were both driving and they got to a intersection, the black person was expected to yield. In terms of personal interactions, there were just a series of very elaborate rules about how to engage. If you were a black male, you could not light a white woman's cigarette because it implied intimacy. And of course, intimacy was believed to be some, you know, like the ending of civilization. So it was the attitude, it was the taste, it was the values, it was the behaviors. It was the material objects. It was all of that as relate to the southern and border states and to a smaller extent some smaller cities in the north from the 1870s to the 1960s. The reason that we have a museum is for most of my life I was interested in race. I have been and remain interested in race and race relations. I believe that, you know, having grown up, you know, I was born in New York, but I grew up in the Deep South, Mobile, Alabama, and Pritchard, Alabama. I believe growing up a mixed race kid in that time made me think about race a lot. And thinking about it meant reading about it, meant talking about it, meant listening about it. I attended a historically black college, Jarvis Christian College in Hawkins, Texas. Once again, while there, you know, the teachers didn't just teach math, science, biology. They also talked about what it was like to live under Jim Crow. And I'm not sure when it happened, but at some point, I started believing and then eventually having some evidence that objects that were produced during that period, that those objects, they both shaped and reflected attitudes toward African Americans and therefore could be used to teach about what race relations were like in that time. So spent a lifetime collecting the materials. As you said, we have more than 10,000 pieces today. which would make us the largest publicly accessible collection of segregation and anti-black caricatured objects in the country. At least that's what I believe we are. And you ask the question of why. I mean, I guess the short answer is I'm an educator. You know, I have a BA from Historically Black College, Jarvis Christian College, a master's and a PhD from Historically Predominantly White College, The Ohio State. And therefore, and have spent my time since then as an educator. It sounds corny and trite, but I believe in the triumph of dialogue. I'm still one of those people that believes that education can matter, that it can transform, if not an entire culture, it can transform individuals. And so I wanted to create a place where people had real meaningful, even if difficult, discussions about race, and that's what we do.
Well, I keep, as you're talking about the last part about why you do it, I keep thinking about how there is a couple things. One is Judith Herman, who wrote Trauma and Recovery about post-traumatic stress disorder, talked about how atrocities, she talks about the word unspeakable and how atrocities are something that we all don't want to think about, and we don't want to, and there's a conspiracy between, use the word loosely, between the victims and the perpetrators that nobody wants to talk about it because it's so awful. And then I also think about the medical model, about how if somebody has an illness, you need to diagnose it. And I'm sort of putting those two together with your work, that I think the one of the reasons I think your work is so fabulous is that you are diving in and actually looking very specifically at the symptoms of this disease in order to diagnose it. Do you see what I'm trying to get at?
I do. And again, when I'm giving talks around the country, when we get to the question and answer part, someone always raises their hand, stands up and says, in effect, that if we just stop talking about race, racism will go away. And of course, it won't. But the reality is we talk about race all the time. We talk about it in our living rooms. We talk about it in restrooms. We talk about it in restaurants. We talk about it in front of the water cooler at work. But we don't often talk about it in places where our ideas get challenged. And so if you can create a place, it doesn't have to be comfortable, but it can be safe, if that makes sense. And so what we tried to do was to create a place where people can have intelligent, passionate, but civil discussions about race. So it's for us, it has to be speakable. When you were talking, I was thinking that most public museums in the United States that, you know, the sort of the top museums, the larger museums, the so-called flagship museums in St. Louis or Grand Rapids or whatever the city is, most of them have some of the same stuff we have. The difference is that it's in their basements or it's in their storage. In some instances, that's probably a good idea because they don't know how to, how to use it. But it also speaks, I want to make sure I say this the right way, because I like a lot of museum professionals, and what I want to say is they have to be mindful of other factors, like whether or not displaying a piece would influence a donor giving money, or whether or not they're prepared for charges that they themselves are being racist or racially insensitive. And so they become muted by their own perceptions of their reality, their financial reality, their political reality. That's one of the, I think one of the greatest advantages we have is that we're actually a museum designed to speak specifically to racism. I don't think that other museums can ever go as far as we do. But what I'd like to see them do is to become leaders in facilitating some of these discussions. Sorry, I'm ranting a little bit. I'm just I get the whole speakable or when is something speak, whatever, but maybe it's because I'm a sociologist. I believe that there's some things that should always be spoken about. Actually, one of the adages that I live by is that there is no situation where it should require courage to speak. That any situation where it requires courage to speak, there's something wrong with the situation. And I'm meaning this as an absolute. There's nothing relative about, you know, sociologists are often accused of being relativists, but there's nothing relativistic about what I'm saying. There is no situation that requires courage to speak where there's not something wrong with that situation. Now, having said that, it sometimes does require courage to speak, but that just means that there's something wrong with the situation. I wish it were not the case that it did not take courage for some people to speak openly, honestly, and intelligently about race.
Thank you for saying all that. And I want to be really clear that Judith Herman is saying that that's the atrocious situation. She's agreeing with you.
Yes,
that that's the atrocious situation and that we do need to speak about it.
Right.
So when I look at the pictures in the book Understanding Jim Crow, there are, you know, we've been talking about these pieces of racist memorabilia or garbage, as you describe them.
Right.
And we've been talking about them sort of abstractly. And can we, just to give people, this is an audio recording, so we can't actually show people pictures, but can you describe a couple just so people get a taste? And there's, I'll tell you, a couple of them that I found the most shockingly offensive to me. One of them was the cards from the game, from the party game from the 1930s, basically a charades game. That was, one of them was, show how a hungry colored boy would go for roast chicken,
right,
or go through the motions of a colored boy eating watermelon. And this is appalling. And then another that was just dreadful is the whole series of little African American children as, quote, alligator bait. I mean, I've written myself a lot about racism, and I was still stunned at the routine. I think that's what bugs me the most, is the routine horribleness of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I agree with you. A couple things. One is, it's not just, you know, the card that you mentioned, by the way, is a companion card to the image that's on the front of the book, Understanding Jim Crow, which is a little black boy with a watermelon. And on the bottom of that card, although it's not written that way on the book's cover, but it would say, show how a little colored boy would eat watermelon. But in both cases, what you see is that in a safe place, presumably, someone's home, in a place that is producing memories that will one day be nostalgic for the participants, you know, family, you know, your grandparents there, your mother, your sister, your brother, you know, a safe, happy space, you have people enjoying themselves and bonding, and one of the ways they're doing it is through mocking black Americans. And that, you know, is not dissimilar in some ways to white Americans, or even black Americans from that standpoint, in the 1880s, 1890s, 1900s, on minstrel shows, you know, performing in minstrel shows. Or a better example would be people sitting around their homes playing the songs in the, you know, the sheet music from the so-called coon songs, which portrayed black men in much the same way, you know, young black boys are portrayed these days in hip hop and rap, you know, as thugs. And so it becomes participatory. And so much of the racist imagery and racist impact in the objects that we have is related to the piece having a function. It's not just visually there. It's a thing with a purpose. So a racist game, people play the game. A racist postcard, people use it as an actual postcard. They write on the back of it. We have a postcard in the museum that shows a black man being beaten in Delaware, I think in the 1930s. And it's because corporal punishment was legal for criminals. And the postcard, someone wrote, "Dear Aunt Libby, this is what they do to the bad people of Delaware." So the person is interacting with the racist. And, you know, the games at one point in the U.S., black people were targets. I mean, literal targets, where there'd be a banner and a hole cut into the banner. And the banner would have, say, a plantation scene. And people would pay money, you know, $3 for a nickel. And these were actual baseballs. And they would throw and hit, try to hit the black person in the face with the baseball. And this is before, you know, wooden or plastic blacks or the dunk tank were substituted many years later. So I it's taking me a long time to say that it's not just that the images are offensive. What is also offensive is that the everyday functionality of the piece meant that people participated in it. So there actually were people who in their homes got down on the floor and ate watermelon the way they believed the colored boy would eat it, much to the amusement of the other people in the room. And that's very similar today to when people go to a Partyland USA or Halloween USA and buy a pimp and a whore, or so-called pimp and whore costumes and masks, and then adopt the gait or the behavior that they associate with black people, or put on a black mask, and again, you know, identify some type of persona and act that way. So in that sense, it's very much consistent.
So what is the attraction of I think you've answered this, but maybe I'm just being a little bit slow. What is the attraction of I mean, the minstrel shows were very, very popular. What is that attraction of members of an oppressor class to dress up, to put on makeup and do caricatures of members of an oppressed class? What's the attraction of that?
Well, think, you know, when minstrel shows first started, slavery, you know, it was like the last three decades of slavery. So you had, you had a ready-made a reason for the show's existence. You needed to, or you didn't need to, but it was a part of portraying some of what was believed to be about slaves. That became even more important for some people when slavery ended. So slavery ends, and there is a fear in this country. I'm talking about a real fear. Now, there was always a fear during slavery that blacks would rise up and kill white people. And there's some good information out there about, you know, this kind of fear in history. But when slavery ended, during Reconstruction, you had the emergence of this of a caricature which still exists, and that is the brute. Are the coon as brute. And the difference is that the coon, it first started as a caricature of this flamboyant, you know, dancing, drunken, drinking, fighting black guy on the stage, and it was one of the caricatures on the stage, or stage characters. But then after Reconstruction, or during Reconstruction, that the coon stopped directing his attentions, his criminal attentions, to other blacks, and started directing them to whites. And that's sort of, quote, you know, the difference between the coon and the brute. Now, if you're this culture and you have people in the newspapers who are reading these accounts, these sensationalized accounts of either, quote, coons attacking with straight razors, you know, other black people, or so-called brutes supposedly raping white women and killing white men, what's one of the many ways to deal with it? Well, one of those ways is to change sort of the thrust of minstrel shows, and to have minstrel shows start focusing in a nostalgic way on the so-called good old darkie. So you had this this romanticizing, I can never say sentimentalizing, this romanticizing of Southern plantation life, of the good old days, when darkies knew their places and when they were scared of white people. So the early days, the reason and later the approach was all connected with slavery. When professional minstrel shows started dying out some, and you start finding them mostly in small towns, and they were amateur, we get around the early 1900s into the first half of this century, then those shows became, whether the people realized it or not, they were an outlet for white Americans. I mean, they always had a risque or burlesque kind of component to them, and so a person could put, grease paint on, and when they did that, then they could sort of act out fantasies. And it's kind of a little bit ironic that some of the immigrant groups who came here later, some of the Southern and Eastern Europeans, when they first came here, weren't really treated as whites, and yet they became whites by pretending to be blacks. I mean, by pretending to be black on stage, which is kind of ironic. I don't know if that makes sense or not. So like with some Jews or with the Irish, who became stage performers, as minstrels. So. Man, I keep giving you these really long answers. I'm going to give you a really short answer to the next question you ask.
Okay. Unfortunately, the next question I ask is I think even more complex than the others, or maybe it's easy. It sounds like everything you're describing is that Jim Crow is really, if we're going to reduce it down to its nub, in many ways, it is a gigantic propaganda war.
Yes.
Against the African Americans, against the inferior race, according to the Jim Crow logic.
Well, I would say certainly that propaganda played just a huge role in one of the connections that we make in the museum is to show the relationship between everyday objects and the support of Jim Crow. And of course, we're not adding another piece of this, which is that Jim Crow was not only supported by everyday objects, it was also supported by violence and the threat of violence.
And those seem to be almost like two wings of the same airplane or, whatever. It's a terrible image, but it's each one supports the other.
Yeah.
And there's a quote I'd like to do, if you'd like to respond to this. It's by Michael Eric Dyson. Uh-huh. And it's, "The white supremacy is the conscious or unconscious belief of the investment in the inherent superiority of some, while others are believed to be innately inferior. And it doesn't demand the individual participation of the singular bigot. It's a machine operating in perpetuity because it doesn't demand that somebody be in place driving." So do you agree with that?
Well, I do. That sounds very sociological, actually. The way I would say it would simply be, especially in the case of Jim Crow, is that the system was so complete that you could operate in it without thinking if you were white. It would have been very difficult to do that, however, if you were black, because to have been black under Jim Crow meant to have to be cognizant of who you were and how the system was set up. Because to not be aware, to not be vigilant, to not obey the rules could have gotten you killed. Now, if I'm looking at today, what I would say would be that race still matters in the U.S. It matters in some ways big and in some ways small, Doesn't matter exactly like it used to, but the orderly flow of our society, in other words, the everyday functioning of our society, some groups benefit more than others. It's just a fact. It doesn't mean that an individual's actions don't impact their life circumstances. Doesn't mean, you know, that hard work can't get you. It doesn't mean any of that. But what it does mean is that today in the U.S., a black infant is more likely to die being born than a white infant. And it has little or nothing to do, I just put it this way. And it has a lot to do with just the way our society historically was and continues in some ways.
Well, okay, I want to throw another quote at you, and then I want to come back to this. And the other quote is by Andrea Dworkin, and she's talking about male supremacy, but I think we can substitute the word white, and this works too. And she said, male supremacy is fused into the language so that every sentence both heralds and affirms it. And I think we can talk about that with white supremacy as well.
Well, and I think it's true with male. I think it's true supremacy. I think the word supremacy scares people. I think in some ways, privileges, makes some people more likely to listen to these discussions. I mean, they're less offended by them. And then, of course, there's some people, they're not going to talk about supremacy, privileges, or any of this because they think it's all bullshit. What I would say would be that, again, there are groups of people, or as we would technically say in sociology, there are categories that benefit from the everyday normal functioning in our culture. It is certainly the case that happens with men, with straights, with whites, and not just with whites, but in some cases with people with light skin but not white skin. And certainly it happens with wealth. It's so fascinating to me when people don't, you know, there's people that resist notions of privilege, which I associate with ideas of supremacy, because supremacy is some of the fallout of it is the privilege that comes from being the one that, you know, as the old folks used to say at home, who believe they rule the world. But if, you know, you hear people say, well, this privilege doesn't exist and this privilege doesn't exist. But I think if you think about class, for example, and wealth, when I go to a town to give a talk, I often ask the person who picks me up to take me to the richest part of town and then to take me to the poorest part of town. Well, first of all, there's a difference. I'm not saying that everybody should live in the same type homes, but it's an incredible. You know, here in this nation, which is, you know, the city on the top of the hill, you have people living, I mean, they're in the same culture living in different worlds, if that makes sense. And there are patterns in every city in the U.S. Now, it's also the case that when you get in, when you start looking at the wealth difference, when you start really looking at it, you also notice that there are gender-based realities going on that if you line up all the poor people in the U.S., that there are disproportionate number of females in that line, and that there are disproportionate number of black and brown people in that line. And if you're a sociologist, you notice that it matters what line you're in, because what we call the social goodies, the power, prestige, and property, those things matter in terms of, you know, how long people live, whether or not they're in prison, the quality of their education, their home, it just all matters. Well, one of those correlates in all of that, or one of those factors involved in all of that, is race. You know, and it's so fascinating to me that part of Jim Crow was convincing the poor white, who in many cases was treated as trash, and that's one of the groups that's one of the rare groups where you hear the term trash applied as a derogatory term, right? Someone calling a category of people trash. But, you know, treated in many of the same ways as racial minorities were treated, and yet they believed themselves, because of their white skin, to be superior. So even though they lacked many of the privileges of whiteness, they had some of them, but even though they lacked many of the privileges of whiteness, felt themselves to be, I mean, what an incredible sell job that was.
Yeah. So don't we today? Okay, I'm going to throw this out, but I don't believe this position, so don't get upset. But don't we today live in a colorblind society where, and we have an African American president, everything's groovy, except of course that, you know, 1/3 of African American males from the ages of 18 and 35 are under criminal justice supervision. We'll leave that aside.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you respond? Okay, I want to back up a second. And one of the things that is really central to my own work is that if I feel like laws are very, that you can change, like when slavery was gotten rid of, insofar as it was, that was a very, very important step, an absolutely crucial step. But if there's an underlying bigotry, it will find a new way to be expressed, as we see with Jim Crow. That you have slavery, then you have Jim Crow, and you have the prison industrial system, so that there's this underlying bigotry that remains. No, it's like a stream. How do I say this? It has different manifestations, so the manifestations can change, but there's still the underlying problem. Do you see what I'm trying to get at?
Absolutely. Well, and the reality is, you know, like you go to bed one night and the people that are in charge of segregation, the laws change, the next day they're the ones in charge of implementing desegregation. In other words, the culture didn't, the people didn't change, even when laws changed and the like. And I'll go back before that. When enslavement ended in this country, it only ended for a short while, and there were instances, as I think most people now, or at least people that study history know, where there was, you know, in some instances, a successful effort to re-enslave, you know, African Americans in this country. And sometimes it looked a whole lot like, you know, like the original slavery. I mean, you could call it debt servitude or peonage or whatever else, but like where I grew up down south, it looked a whole lot like slavery. So, and then the rewriting of constitutions and the like. You know, I don't know, I'm going to say something that's, well, first, let me get back to the post-racial thing. What I wish we were as a country is a country that stopped saying colorblind. Although I think a lot of times when people say colorblind, their hearts are in the right places. What they're trying to say is that they want to live in a society where they don't discriminate against people. Okay, and we can debate whether they do or they don't. But like I said, their hearts are in the right place. So they say, well, you know, I'm colorblind. Well, you're not colorblind. But I hear, or at least I want to be generous, it as a listener and say, okay, but I hear you saying that you don't want to mistreat people, but that doesn't deal with the larger structural problems or set up in our society. Although it's good that each of us as an individual is reflective about who we are, how we engage with members of other communities, how we engage with members of our own community who look different. So that's all good, but there's a overarching narrative that has existed almost from the beginning in this country, and it is that white people are superior in all ways that matter to black people, and that overarching narrative, underneath it. It became this sort of umbrella, and underneath it were a number of smaller narratives, and within those were ideas about black people used to support the narrative, and ideas about white people. And so you have the caricatures, and you know, the Mammy, the Tom, the Coon, the Sambo, the Sapphire, the Buck, the Nat. Well, you know, just you know, all groups have been caricatured, but none is in this country as often as African Americans. And so you have this series of all these caricatures which reduce black people to one-dimensional beings, And then you have stereotypes, which are different from care. You have stereotypes that black people are dumb, that they're stupid, that they're ugly, that they stink, that their heads are hard, they don't feel pain, which, and you have dozens and dozens of stereotypes, which you apply to any number of caricatures, which are then used to support this bigger narrative, okay? And one other part of that narrative is that when you have two groups so different sharing the same space, that conflict is inevitable. It may not be violent conflict, but it's inevitable. And if you trace the history of black and white, blacks and whites in the United States, you'll see that much of the interaction has been, that has been the backdrop, that has been the influencer, that has been the shaper of that interaction. And I would make the argument that our struggle today continues to be this struggle between us. And I wish we would just as a nation say that this was this narrative. These were these ideas which were used to support it. And it has not completely disappeared in the U.S. And then finally, about the post-racial thing, I don't. The society I want to live in is not post-racial. It's this is going to sound like a bumper sticker on somebody's car, but I want to live in a post-racist society. And I think that there has been some progress in the U.S. I think you lose credibility when you don't recognize the progress. The other reason I have to recognize the progress that's being made is because I don't want to dishonor the people, black and white, who fought for social change in this country. And in the museum we have, pictures of, Goodman, Swarney, and Cheney. I mean, we have pictures of, I just forgot their names, the boys killed at the Orangeburg Massacre. Although they weren't necessarily fighting for change, their deaths were important in terms of the civil rights movement in South Carolina. I mean, I don't want to dishonor people's, first I think objectively you can say there has been progress in the U.S., but, yeah, I just lost my train of thought. Sorry.
No, I love everything you're saying. It's incredibly powerful. And so I guess the question is you said at one point that the Jim Crow era, you said it went through the 1960s.
Right.
And how do you see, I guess, and you talked about the stereotypes in film, literature. What would you see as the current manifestation? Okay, here's the question. How would you like to see, say, current film or literature, how would you like to see that change to move even farther away from those stereotypes,
well,
or to get rid of them?
Yeah, the simple answer is this. Present
while maintaining the understanding. I love what you said about post-racist versus post-racial. I love that. So maintaining the integrity of the peoplehood, I guess. And sorry, go ahead.
No, that's fine. The easy answer for me is present African Americans, Latino Americans, poor white Americans, whoever the group is, present them as whole people. That's just the simple answer. Caricatures share, even though caricatures differ in terms of the way they portray group, they share that the people are reduced to be, one-dimensional. So the so-called Jezebel caricature, portrays African-American women as hypersexual, and that becomes their master status. You know, the man is, this loyal servant. The trick is, it's not even a trick. It's whether or not as a culture we're willing, both as producer and consumer of what's produced, to receive images of African American people as fully, wholly developed. And I tell you, I'm optimistic about a lot of things, contrary to some of the things I've said in the last, during this interview, but I'm not that confident in either the producers or the consumers, in especially in with movies and with some of the other entertainment pieces, because it seems like if you try to portray African Americans again as whole people with flaws, ambitions, you know, the whole range, that you know, you have people saying that's not a realistic it's not a realistic depiction of who, you know, who those people are. So I think we're a ways away from that. But like I said, the easy answer is not, I mean, but the desired result is to get there. Much of my work is about, in the U.S.'s history, the many, many instances when we didn't do that, and then me trying to explain what the consequences were for African Americans and for the larger society that those African Americans were portrayed in those ways.
So maybe this is a way of asking something that you've already said 15 times, but I'm thinking two things. One is, so many indigenous people have said to me that the first and most important thing that we have to do is to decolonize our hearts and minds.
Right.
And I'm thinking of a line by Anton Chekhov where some young person asked him what he should write about. He said, "I want to write a story. I don't know what to write about." Mm-hmm. And Anton Chekhov said, "I want you to write a story about a character who squeezes every drop of slave's blood out of his body." And so how does one, whether one, and two different situations, I guess, whether one is African American or whether one is any other group, including white,
yeah,
how does one decolonize? How does one drive Jim Crow out of one's own body?
That is profound. I mean, that is great. I don't want to make everything sound so simplistic, but part of it is to tell your own story and to tell it with an eye toward it failing. And by that, what I mean is, you know, write the book that you need to write, even if writing the real book means nobody buys it. Make the movie that tells the real story, even if it, quote, fails, because even the audience that you would most like to see it resonate with don't like it, because they don't want it, because it's not what they're used to. So tell your own story and tell it in a way that is authentic. And again, there's no market for that, or there's very little market for that, or there's less market for that. I give you that. Here's a little tiny thing. I was trying to collect bus, B-U-S-T-S. I spell it because when I get excited that my southern accent and all the other stuff kicks in. So I want you to understand. So I tried to find as many buses I could of famous African Americans, or not so famous ones, who lived during the Jim Crow period, because I wanted to have a section of the museum, are several sections of the museum, which talked about what you might call positive stories or redemptive stories, but which I see as, you know, responses to Jim Crow. I tell you, after you got out of the February group, you know, MLK, Harriet Tubman, I'm just trying to think, Booker T. Washington, George Washington Carver, I mean, it's like 8 or 12, and then there just weren't any more. And I thought to myself, why would there – I mean, this society is full of busts, of little figurines, of little figures, of just literally tens of thousands of people. Why am I having such a hard time finding, these little statues of African-Americans and a range of people, not just 12 different versions of one person? And then I talked to more and more people, and sort of the consensus was there's no real market for that. I mean, people talk about there being a market, but there's no real market. And my hope is that becomes less true all the time. So people have to tell their own stories, tell them in ways that are authentic, even if it means that by most standards, those things fail.
Well, that's, thank you. That's very profound. And we have like 2 minutes left. And do you have, do you want to end on that? Or is there something else you would like to say to people, especially in the United States, but anywhere, about your work and about what we do now?
Well, I, first of all, thank you again. I wish, I mean, we're located, you know, I joke and say we're located 1,500 miles north of Miami, Florida. obviously, that doesn't help people get here. You know, we're a couple, 3 hours from Detroit. We're in a rural area, and yet we have people find us from all over the world. We have people come from Australia to use us as a template to build their a place there that deals with Aborigines. So I wish people do come. We're free. And my final thing is this. You use the term offense, that you found some offense to some things. And I'm going to give you another way to look at that, which is it's a perverted measure, but I sometimes use the fact that people are offended at things today they wouldn't have been offended in years past as a perverted measure of progress, if that makes sense.
That makes perfect sense.
Okay.
So I guess one last thing. I mentioned before that this is at Ferris State University. Where is that?
Ferris State is in Big Rapids, Michigan, which is about 40 miles north of Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Well, Understanding Jim Crow is a really, really important book, and I really recommend people read it, and I recommend they come to your museum, and thank you so much for your work. I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been David Pilgrim. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.